Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Now to introduce Lauren Michaels, Herb Schlosser, Chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Museum of the Moving Image. While Herb was president of NBC, he put Saturday Night Live on the air, so there's no one more fitting as an introducer tonight. Herb.
Back in 1975, in the spring, NBC began to think about putting a program on at 11:30 at night. We had the Today Show and the Tonight Show, which were very successful under the brilliant Pat Weaver, and we put on some other late-night programs, and they always worked. So we decided that we would do it. We only had three conditions that we would like to achieve to begin with. One was that it be live, that it be in the Toscanini studio that was created by General Sarnoff for the NBC Symphony Orchestra, and that it go on at 11:30 at night. Now, we were thinking, because Johnny Carson had left New York for California and the building was without that activity and excitement, that we would do a kind of hipper version of The Tonight Show with younger people and so forth and so on. And then we hired a 30-year-old writer called Lorne Michaels. And we got so much more than we ever bargained for. Dick Ebersole, who was in the program department, was the program executive. But Lorne created the show. And it had certain characteristics. It had brilliant writing. The casting was outstanding. And most important, Lorne was not afraid. He was willing to test the limits of what the executives would permit and test the audience as well. And he was willing to put pins into balloons, say outrageous things, and he created something new. And Lorne got the respect of the audience. We had great audiences. And beyond that, he got the respect of the entire creative community. And it was a great success. And it goes on today after 33 years. There's really no other show that has managed to achieve that. And as you've seen tonight, then in the political realm, there's no program which every 4 years creates the kind of excitement that Saturday Night Live does, and as it did last Saturday night, if some of you saw it. I was told by one of the NBC executives that last Saturday's show had the highest opening rating of any show in 7 or 8 years. I mean, it really captures the imagination of the country. And Lorne did it. He did it. And NBC and the country has benefited from it. The talent that the show has developed has gone on to motion pictures and other areas. I think that if you added up the gross of all the movies of the Saturday Night Live talent, you'd be talking about many billions of dollars. Its impact has been huge, and it still continues, and it's my pleasure to introduce Lorne Michaels. Now, the panel will be moderated by David Schwartz, whom you saw just a few moments ago. And the other panelists are James Downey, a writer for Saturday Night Live. He's been with the show since 1976 and has written many, if not most, of the political sketches. And Seth Meyers, Seth is in his eighth season on the show. He's the head writer and weekend update co-anchor, and Amy Poehler. She's in her seventh season on the show and weekend update co-anchor. And she's played Hillary, as you've seen. And now she has a great career, I believe, in motion pictures as well.
Bristol Palin's sketch for.
That's
right. Before I was going to start originally by talking about Gerald Ford and Chevy Chase, but since everybody is talking about Sarah Palin these days, let's get into this sketch that you just did. As background, let's talk a little bit about Hillary, because the sketch combined Hillary and Sarah Palin. And I just want to remind people of the impact that the show had. Way back, it seems like years ago, but it was in the March, I guess, late February, when Hillary appeared on the show. And the sketch led to an actual mention of Saturday Night Live in a real debate. And then Hillary came on in person. So we see sort of politics and entertainment playing interesting roles. So let's talk first about that sketch and Hillary's appearances earlier.
Well, Jim wrote the debate piece, the first sort of Hillary Obama debate piece, and the thrust of it was that the media was infatuated with Obama, and I think it was it wouldn't have gotten the reaction it got if it hadn't resonated, and then I think that sent the Hillary people off in a trajectory and. They wanted to come on the show, and she mentioned it in one of the debates.
And it wasted a lot of time.
Yeah,
everyone's part.
Yeah.
And could you talk about what it was like creating the impersonation and then actually dealing with having to do a sketch with the real Hillary?
Well, it's always weird to be next to someone dressed as them, no matter if they're a politician or not. It was what you would imagine it would be, kind of surreal, but you get used to, on SNL, having very surreal moments on that show. I don't consider myself a really great impersonator, and so I wouldn't say that I probably sound very much like her or even look like her, but I think with Jim's guidance in terms of him writing the pieces and kind of helping me find a voice, I think it was interesting over the last couple of years to try to find what you could kind of play about her.
There's a thing that happens on the show too. Amy is a great example of it. Dana Carvey, when he was doing the first President Bush, there's a point for me where you sort of start watching Dana do Bush or her do Hillary, and you begin, when you see the real person, they sort of disappoint you a little. because they've encapsulated some essence of them, and they become characters as opposed to impressions.
Right. Well, I think as viewers, we all sort of wait to see how that person is going to get the SNL treatment, because in a way that becomes a job of the show is to sort of get at this essence that you're talking about. Could you talk about what your thinking was? Like, when did you first see Sarah Palin and start to put this the idea together of how you were going to treat her?
It seemed like, you know, when you have you only have this one opportunity a year to sort of have a lot of time to think of what the story of sort of the summer is. And it seemed like at the time we came back, it was Sarah Palin. Now we only have, 5 days to come up with something for this week.
I think it's still Sarah Palin.
It might still be Sarah Palin, of course. Thank you, Sarah Palin. So we wanted to do a piece about that. And, I think the trick with all these people is to try to come out as sort of fair and even-handed as possible. And it seemed to make sense as well when you have, obviously, we had Tina Fey back and we had Amy. It's the least amount of applause.
Tina would be furious at that amount of money.
But, you know, when you have faith with two performers, you put them out there, there's going to be a natural charisma. So you have that. And it was a nice way to sort of use Hillary's, what we believe is probably her disappointment that Sarah Palin is closer to the White House than her. Using that idea was made it safer to sort of mention things about Sarah Palin without it looking like sort of an attack piece, which is, I think, is always the fear.
A lot of sexual chemistry.
Well, you know, my dream is you, Tina, in a podium. but it was really nice, you know, because once we came up with the premise, which was a fairly simple one, a lot of people sort of pitched in with different jokes, and it was one of the more fluid pieces we've done in that it was changing up until, you know, the last minute, and I think the results turned out okay.
Yeah. Up until like 5 minutes before I went on, I was playing Palin.
Right, that was a terrible decision.
Lauren caught it just in time.
Like, that's why you're
I knew there was something wrong. Yeah.
But what you're obviously looking for laughs. I mean, that's what makes the show work. But you know that that your comedy does have some sort of impact. I mean, there have been times. We'll talk about Al Gore and the debates a little bit later. But you must have some sense that what you do is going to have an impact on how people think of Sarah Palin. Do you think about this or not? Or how do you deal?
Yeah,
with it?
I think you think about it. But the thing you think about first is whether it's going to work and whether it's going to be funny and if the take is original and fresh enough. And I think you can't think about the fate of Western civilization. And and we don't. You know, we're part of it, but we're not. Nobody's making. Honestly, nobody's going into the booth and going, you know, I watch SNL, now I'm clear on what to do. I think it's that we're just part of it, and invariably we're part of it because we deal with the small part of it.
Right.
We don't try and deal with, you know, in that grandiose way of what's best for the country, and none of this stuff works unless it's hits pretty close. You can't go out there and just do a partisan rant. I mean, you can do that if you're on MSNBC, but you can't. You can't really do it. In comedy, because if you lose the audience, you lose them real fast.
But was it odd then to see that when you did the sketch about Hillary, that the mainstream media started sort of repeating this idea that she was getting it too, or that she was getting the hard questions? I mean, that showed up in it and seemed to actually have an impact in the real debates.
I feel like the media also, like, you know, that piece was a more criticism of the media than anything else. So I think there was just a sort of an inner delight that the piece was about the media.
Right.
And then the media started talking about the media, and
right.
And then they were like, are we doing this?
And no one, all part of the plan.
Yeah.
And no one follows the press more avidly than the press.
Right.
But then, of course, you know, the snake sort of ate its own tail when Hillary mentioned it. In the debate the next week.
And we're not 100% sure she ever saw it.
No.
There's no evidence from the way she quoted it.
Yeah.
We one time we were talking about doing a show called The Nielsens. Do you remember that? And we decided it would be the highest rated show ever on television.
The Nielsen.
Yeah. But we should have done that.
We should have. Yeah.
It's not too late.
No.
Okay. So, let's take, I guess... based on what Herb said and about the ratings for the show and the internet viewings, I guess most of you have seen the sketch that ran on Saturday. In case you haven't or just want to see it with a live audience here, let's run this the opening sketch of Saturday night's show with Tina Fey and Amy Poehler.
And now, a nonpartisan message from Governor Sarah Palin and Senator Hillary Clinton.
Americans. I was so excited when I was told Senator Clinton and I would be addressing you tonight.
And I was told I would be addressing you alone.
Now, I know it must be a little bit strange for all of you to see the two of us together. What with me being John McCain's running mate
and me being a fervent supporter of Senator Barack Obama, as evidenced by this button. But tonight we are crossing party lines to address the now very ugly role that sexism is playing in the campaign. An issue which I am frankly surprised to hear people suddenly care about. You know, Hillary and I don't agree on everything.
Anything.
I believe that diplomacy should be the cornerstone of any foreign policy.
And I can see Russia from my house.
I believe global warming is caused by man.
And I believe it's just God hugging us closer.
I don't agree with the Bush doctrine.
And I don't know what that is.
But, Sarah, one thing we can agree on is that sexism can never be allowed to permeate an American election.
So please, stop photoshopping my head on sexy bikini pictures.
And stop saying I have cankles.
Don't refer to me as a MILF.
And don't refer to me as a flurge. I Googled what it stands for and I do not like it.
Reporters and commentators, stop using words that diminish us like pretty, attractive, beautiful.
Harpy, shrew, boner shrinker.
While our politics may differ, my friend and I are both very tough ladies. You know, it reminds me of a joke we tell in Alaska.
Oh, boy.
What's the difference
Lipstick.
Between a hockey mom
Lipstick.
And a pit bull?
Lipstick.
Lipstick.
There you go.
Just look at how far we've come. Hillary Clinton, who came so close to the White House, and me, Sarah Palin, who is even closer. Can you believe it, Hillary?
I cannot!
It's truly amazing, and I think women everywhere can agree that no matter your politics, it's time for a woman to make it to the White House.
No! Mine! It's supposed to be mine. I'm sorry, I need to say something. I didn't want a woman to be president. I wanted to be president, and I just happen to be a woman. And I don't want to hear you compare your road to the White House to my road to the White House. I scratched and clawed through mud and barbed wire, and you just glided in on a dog sled. Wearing your pageant sash and your Tina Fey glasses.
Amazing time we live in. To think that just 2 years ago I was a small town mayor of Alaska's crystal meth capital. And now I am just one heartbeat away from being president of the United States. It just goes to show that anyone can be president.
Anyone. Anyone. Anyone.
All you have to do is want it.
Yeah. You know, Sarah, looking back, if I could change one thing, I probably should have wanted it more.
So, in the next 6 weeks, I invite the media to be vigilant for sexist behavior.
Although it is never sexist to question female politicians' credentials, please ask this one about dinosaurs. Conclusion, I invite the media to grow a pair. And if you can't, I will lend you mine.
And as we say in Alaska,
we say it everywhere.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
Ha ha!
No, that's me laughing.
did you? What has the response been like politically? Do you get responses from people who say you were too hard on her? When are we going to see the Joe Biden sketch? Do people sort of gauge what you should be doing politically?
I think it's one of those interesting things, which is I think probably people who are on the left think it was just hard enough, and I bet people on the right love it too. I mean, I think that the Palin people were perfectly happy with that as well, which is the weird thing. I mean, even when not doing political sketches, I've done impersonations of people in the past that are not that flattering, and then you meet them and they're like, oh my God, that was the best! Because they just like the cultural significance of being on the show.
Well, the report was that she watched it on the campaign plane and said that she was happy because she used to dress as Tina Fey at Halloween parties.
So we lucked into that.
Right. But it covers a lot of ground, that sketch. A lot of topics, a lot of the issues that came up during Hillary's campaign. Could you talk a bit about how this sketch evolved, or were there other rejected Palin sketches that you could tell us about that you didn't do?
That's a good idea. Let's talk about the ones we didn't do.
It is funny how there are moments in it, anything that gets a little preachy, doesn't work quite as well. Mm-hmm. The jokes, you watch it again, you're happier with the jokes than anything that sort of takes the high road. I think that you always have to remember when we write these pieces. I also want to add that the last word we added to that sketch was boner shrinker. And as I heard that, I was like, why are we on a panel for a museum? What have we done?
Yeah.
That was a change from Boner Killer.
It was Boner Killer. I wasn't going to say that, but it was Boner Killer. And surprisingly, Boner Killer chilled the audience, but people love Boner Shrinker.
Yeah.
And did a lot of people look up Flurge?
I don't know. But it does not stand for anything.
No. I was going to ask.
Nothing.
Well, what does it
mean?
No.
There was a couple funny people that were like, oh, I know what that stands for. And I was like, oh, okay.
We just liked that there was a term that people had created just to call Hillary Clinton.
Right.
And nobody knows what it is.
Did you guys watch Saturday Night Live growing up? I have such indelible memories of all these, all the sketches that we saw, that opening reel. I vividly remember each of them. Just wondering what your memories are and what sketches made an impression.
Absolutely did. And in fact, when you're younger, you watch the political stuff in a different way. I mean, at least I did when I was younger. You don't really know who the people are or the issues are. You like them as characters. I didn't know who when I was, well, I wasn't born when it... No, I'm kidding. No. Let's see, what was it? When I was 70...
Four?
I was four.
Yeah.
So the first cast... I was in love with Eddie Murphy. That was who was my person at the time. But the first, all the the Ford stuff, I didn't get it. I didn't get what was other than I loved Chevy falling down.
And from a very young age, I read the New York Times, so I did get all those jokes. But again, I think I'm the unique one, though. I think most people would be. The show that taught me my sensibilities about doing political writing is now the show I work on. And most of those pieces were written by Jim as I started to work. I realized that. He holds it over me.
For sure.
So what was it like from the very beginning? Because I think Chevy, the impersonation of Gerald Ford and the way that became sort of part of the race, and then Ron Nessen, the White House press secretary, I guess he asked to be on the show. So politics and the show were married right from the beginning.
Right, but we came on, right after Watergate, and everyone had watched the hearings for 6 months, and I think... It was just part of what where that generation was at the time. And I think one of the sort of bold things, which seems not at all bold now, but was when Chevy did Gerald Ford, which was, I think, from the fifth or sixth show, he made absolutely no effort to look like Gerald Ford.
Right.
And I think that was sort of I remember this moment. First time he was doing it, we were sort of a little tense over doing it. And there was a moment before the first laugh when he didn't hear the first laugh, so he sneezed into his tie. And I thought, can't do that with the President of the United States, but evidently you could. So I think that it just sort of matured into, into people looking like, the people they're playing, and it got more sophisticated. The very first debate, which they showed a bit of, which was Ford Carter, that high point of I didn't know that there would be any math, sort of encapsulated the take on Ford, and Carter talking that kid down from a bad acid trip sort of summarized everything that we thought about Carter. We opted, particularly in the 80s, with like Dukakis After Dark, which is a Jim piece, they just got silly, and fun. And I think if they're not fun, then it's like taking medicine. Not that the op-ed page isn't a lot of fun. But that's our job is to find a way to make it light and work.
The Reagan sketch was brilliant because a lot of times, the way to make fun of candidates or presidents is to pretend that they're dumb, and the idea that Reagan had this sort of false happy persona, and it was totally different when he was behind the scenes was a brilliant idea.
Jim was involved in that.
Talk about that, Jim.
Yeah, go ahead.
That's your cue.
It was actually like, I think five of us wrote that. It was unusual in that it was sort of a gang-written piece, and I think the only thing that was essential was the fact that Phil Hartman could handle that, all that speed stuff. We had him like speaking Arabic and German, and he was like trading Swiss marks for francs and stuff on the phone, and then like he'd go out and do the thing. We had Jimmy Stewart, I think, interrupt him or something, but that was that's one that people, I suppose, just because so many people still don't like Reagan, they keep bringing up to me. But Phil Hartman was really the you couldn't have done that with a lot of performers.
Yeah.
You certainly could with Amy and Seth.
Or Dan Aykroyd. But I think that one of the things that was difficult about Reagan, and I think is very much the problem we have with Bush, this president, in the last few years, is when the audience knows everything there is to know about them, there's nothing, it's very hard to find an edge. I mean, so much of the criticism of Reagan in his first term and then, much more so in the second term was that he was old, he was an actor, he was a generalist, but the audience was way ahead.
Well, kind of lucked out with Reagan in that you and I were away from the show for his entire first term.
Yeah, which was a plan.
I had come back a year before Warren, and I had written a piece, which I only mention this because I was exactly right in the politics. Forget the comedy, but it was a piece in the 84 election. It was Mondale planning his campaign to win Minnesota. Yeah. So it was like the big war room had a map of the state. And it was like, like sending people into different counties and stuff. And that was the only state he won. But we got to the second term, I guess we were there for the full second term, pretty much.
Yeah.
And we had an easier time. What happened to us with, Bush Sr. was one term. Clinton, different things kept happening to him. I wasn't really at the show for the last 2 years of Clinton's term. But the problem with George W. is that in for 8 years, I'm the guy who came up with Strategery, and I got sort of bored with the the mispronunciation kind of thing. And then also when Will left the show, I think it's safe to talk about this. I mean, there was a problem that we cast about. I think Daryl tried him first, and then we went to Parnell, and then we went back to Daryl, and then we went to Will Forte.
Yeah.
And so by the time, like that clip you showed from the thing I wrote for Bush Kerry, I'm trying to remember, who's he in that piece? Oh, yeah, he's Bush. And this, it's nice to, for our purposes, it'd be nice if they changed every 4 years.
Yeah.
I think, because you get,
term limits.
So,
looking at some of those clips, though, I remember how much I loved Hartman's Clinton and how much I loved Daryl's Clinton, too.
Yeah.
Those are, they did.
They're very different.
They're
but
very
one of the pleasant surprise for me, I wrote we had not done Carter since he was president. I mean, there wasn't a lot of reason to. And then there was a thing a few years ago where he went down to Cuba, and I remember writing a piece where Daryl did Carter talking to Castro with Maya as like his translator. I love writing foreign language pieces with translation. It's sort of a tic I have. But but Daryl did the cruelest, which is to say the funniest Carter I've ever seen, because he had every kind of like those weird facial pops in the thing. And do you guys remember that?
Yeah.
And you know, I'd love to have Daryl do Carter again anytime.
Well, he did it last season, didn't he?
Yeah. He did a Larry King piece where Larry King was, he had just written a book, and Larry King was like, now, do you expect anyone to buy this book?
But he has that thing where his eyes suddenly go, you know, it's like for no good reason.
It's interesting to watch Daryl sort of as you talk about these impressions, because like, you know, I do think there's this sort of two kinds of impressions, you know, the ones where you make it a character, and then Daryl, and then there's ones where you're sort of a... just a technician about it, and I think Daryl's the one who.
Yeah, Daryl's like inductive, where he like assembles the impression from like a thousand little elements.
Yeah.
And then there's the broad stroke kind of coming from the other direction.
Yeah.
It's also that voice is Gore, you know, kind of leads you because noticing the wig he was wearing. You know, sorry.
It's funny though. That, like Daryl will come to you when you like write like in recent years when you've written a Gore piece. He's like, do you want 2000 Gore? Do you want now Gore? Because like he's actually noticed that Gore changes, and then he does a Gore that's not sort of the greatest hits Gore, and you're like, well, I think just do the 2000 Gore that everyone loves. And in his head, he's like, all right,
you know, we're gonna get letters on that.
Yeah, you know, a lot of letters.
There were a few different 2000 Gores. I mean, the famous story was that after the first debate with all the sighing, that. And I don't know if this is true or not, but that Gore's...
I can actually vouch for
its truth. Okay, so that Gore's advisor sat him down and said, look at this sketch from Saturday Night Live, and then he went out and changed his performance in the second debate.
I was at Al Franken's apartment, and we were doing a... We were writing wraparounds for a...
Right.
That's right, the Al Franken. And we were writing wraparounds for this political best of, and there's going to be another one, presidential bash coming up November 2nd, Sunday, 9?
I don't know.
Anyway, and this guy, who I suppose I could name him, maybe I shouldn't. It's true, though, Eli Addy. He worked for the Gore campaign, and he calls Franken up while we're working, and he goes, and Al's like, maybe I should do this later. I go, no, do it now. I want to hear this. And so they were talking. They'd just shown Gore the piece. And so I know, because Eli, I got on the extension and eavesdropped. And so he was explaining how, we made him watch it because it's really, and then I watched the next debate, and he sort of went from, because it was all the sighing and the sort of the bullying stuff, and then he was just such a little wallflower in the next one. That was made it more fun because it was like you say, it was like three different Gores. Yeah. And then it kind of evened out by they had a town hall debate where it was just kind of a lot of like special pleader kind of questions from the audience, if you remember that one. But there really were three different Gores and also a couple different Bushes, because the second one, he was able to, you know, that was the one where they really, really schooled Bush on a few basic things. So he kept mentioning like obscure, you know, members of the Nigerian cabinet.
Right.
And
stuff. So speaking of Democratic candidates who are painful to watch at times, let's. What was it like playing John Kerry? You know, building up that.
It wasn't a comedy jackpot. I was lucky in that, you know, Jim was writing great stuff for it, but it's hard when, you know, you try to try to find something to exaggerate, and when it's gravitas, you know, that
it's it's the only Kerry impression I've ever seen. He's not an easy impression. I actually thought you did a great job, because anyone will tell you that there's some Hillary Clinton is really hard. Yeah. I'd say Kerry is just about as hard.
And I think it was he let you down.
Oh, he definitely did. He definitely did.
That's the way to look at it.
It's funny, like, I realized in recent years how you feel people be like, you know, I've said about, like Bush, like, people want to vote for people they think they'd like to have a beer with. And I was actually at a Red Sox game last year, and John Kerry was there, and I was actually having a beer with him. I'm like, you should always vote for the other guy. It'll increase your chance of having a beer with the loser. But it was, you know, it was great. I mean, like, it is thrilling to be in an SNL debate sketch, It's thrilling to be in a cold open.
It's thrilling to say live from New York.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. It's as simple as that.
And the debates are so perfectly... there's such a perfect design for us to write sketches about, because then the sketch... You're making fun of both sides just by design, because both sides are performing at the debates.
So what's your plan for the first debate, which is on a Friday night?
Yeah.
Jesus, give us a
break. Jim's already got it done.
Yeah. Monday, it's Monday.
We'll probably have some prefab stuff that you can imagine is likely to come up, and then just have a hellish night and hope for the best.
I think there's another point that sort of gets lost a little bit, which is that there's also the likability of the cast member playing the person. Yeah. I think Amy's Hillary is a perfect example of it, because Amy is one of the best loved people ever at the show, and you sort of people like I didn't mean to do that. What I meant with it was that if you like Will Ferrell and he does Strategery, you're more on the side of Bush.
Right.
Because you like who's playing him, you know. And I think there's, if you feel a connection, when the fact that the audience already liked Chevy and him doing Gerald Ford as a, you know, a guy who falls down. I mean, I'd like to say we had more of a take than that. But, it was very early days, and
we didn't have the budget.
We didn't have the budget then, you know. But you know, it's that there's also connecting with the performer. And I think if you like the person doing it, that has an influence.
So you've probably been surprised when some of the people you were spoofing adopted these performers as friends. Like the first George Bush, I guess, was quite friendly and enjoyed Dana Carvey's.
And what was so interesting about the Sarah Palin thing was that there are two people at the show right now who could do her and do her perfectly. But that was the situation where the audience just cast Tina Fey.
Right.
You know, emails, you know, letter, you just, everybody you talk to, go, what a gift, huh? You know, you can have so much fun with Tina Fey. But, you know, when I go, well, she's actually on her own show now. You know, but it was like that, the audience sort of felt that's what they wanted to see. And then when that moment came together, which it did, I think,
Now they're all going to want money because they all think they thought
yeah.
of it.
Yeah, no, I know.
It was a collective scratch
to
a giant itch.
That's what the rebate was for.
You sort of answered this before, but do you think it's true that many people get their political news from comedy or their ideas about political? This is something that we hear a lot, that young people, you know, get their news more from The Daily Show than watching TV news. You know, this Sunday there were two lengthy pieces in print in the New York Times and Washington Post about Sarah Palin, long investigative pieces that were important if people read them, but probably many more people saw your show. But
the people who write these things read them.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just a distillation of the same information, you know, with a point of view. And I think that you can encapsulate it. I mean, there are lots of, you know, there are lots of op-ed writers, particularly at the Times, who can be very funny and witty, and that's part of what they do, but they do it in a different form. Ours is, we just have to distill it. I mean, you could tell from Tina kind of waving from the first moment she spoke that they were there with it, that it got something right. And in the same way with, you know, with Hillary, you kind of go, I don't think it's in any way. Her Hillary is her Hillary. You know, it's not like you go, God, she's similar to what Amy does. It's like we have a character Hillary who's continually put upon. You know, it's continually always, you know, at the point of, you know, explosive rage.
So since
bending the thing off,
Since I brought up news, and could you talk about your approach to Weekend Update and how you sort of deal with the news as it's breaking during the week and decide how you're going to put
One of the nice things about Weekend Update, it's sort of a last stop for for any stories that have sort of slipped through our fingers, because, you know, at the later in the week, the harder it is to sort of build a set or anything like that. But, you know, we have our features, which are people who come on and do pieces. So we can always cover stuff there. And it's also been a really nice home in the last sort of year for political candidates to come on.
Right.
You know, you get them there, and it's just nice to... it's nice for us to have pictures of them at the desk, to be honest. but it's you know, it's good. You know, we obviously, we try to open covering, you know, what our top hard news stories. And then, you know, as Weekend Update rolls on, there's sort of more sillier jokes. You know, but it is still for us, like, it is a, it's a, you know, it's a parody of a news show. It's not, I would not get your news from Weekend Update.
Oh, God. Yikes.
But I think on cable, people do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, I think The Daily Show and,
yeah,
you know.
Those aren't bad places to get your,
yeah,
news.
But
this is.
Yeah.
And how do you deal with the fact that when a politician comes on the show, they really are seeking some political gain? I mean, when Hillary appeared on the show, I mean, she has an agenda when Barack Obama appears. I mean, I guess when Huckabee appeared, it was a bit late in the game for him.
Yeah.
But
Huckabee was on his gift,
you
know, basket part of running for president.
Yeah.
He really was. I said, I was like, why are you still in the race? He's like, well, would you have had me if I wasn't?
Yeah.
Really?
That was the whole raison d'etre of Al Sharpton's run, I,
yeah,
think.
Yeah.
Was the per diem. But this is back before the year before you came, Jesse Jackson hosted the show.
Right.
And, you know, they always, you know, obviously anything that they do enhances your writing. It's much cooler than, like, one of our people impersonating them in that sense. On the other hand, for that very reason, they're not going to do everything.
Yeah.
And I remember when Jesse Jackson, goes way back for a lot of you here tonight, but he was the Rainbow Coalition, was like the black, brown, you know, yellow, everybody. And so I wanted to do this piece about, like, you know, he does the Rainbow Coalition thing. He says, but that doesn't mean we have to take everybody in the Rainbow Coalition. So it was a list of all the groups not welcome. And in the Rainbow Coalition, it was like, of course, it was an insane thing that I ever thought he would do it. But I'm sitting there with him and his guys. It's like, won't do that, won't do that, won't do that, won't do that. It was like three things were left. And just this spring, McCain, I wrote a piece for McCain about, you know, he's the big pork buster, and there were certain outrageous programs that are just, why are we spending money on this? And I remember one of them was, I would so love to see John McCain do this on television, but it was like, and what about this? $150 million to the Department of Justice for a program that notifies convicted sex offenders when a child moves into his neighborhood. And it was one that, please, just don't read the script, yeah, until you're out there. And, but they were too smart for me.
Right.
And it was like, Senator, really? Just come on, just take another, you know. No, it's not.
Yeah, they have to maintain a certain level of gravitas.
Right.
But does it have to be that high?
Yeah, no. But I think, you know, it's hard to trust someone with no apparent sense of humor.
When Al Gore did that hot tub sketch, people were speculating whether he was going to run or not.
Yeah, no, it was that weekend.
That seemed to be...
That was the weekend he announced he wasn't going to run.
And he was very loose on the show. He was ready to do anything on the show. And we were saying...
Even if
that week, we were saying he's not going to run. Because he was saying yes to so many pieces.
And, yeah.
And also, I think if more people had seen that Al Gore in 2000, I think it would have had an effect.
But I remember seeing...
He did win the popular vote, didn't he?
Yeah, he did.
Yeah, right.
But I remember seeing, I think it was Bob Dole or somebody was on saying, the moment I saw that hot tub thing, I knew Al's not running for president.
Right.
I will say it's very... for me, the joy is when political... Because Al Gore came back and did the address a few years ago as if it was in an alternate universe, as if he had won president, and things weren't going well. The glaciers were so strong, they were, like, encroaching on Minnesota. And George Bush was the commissioner of baseball.
Yeah.
Right.
But, you know, he was so loose, but there were a few things. I forget who was this. He was a Supreme Court justice joke about... he put somebody on the Supreme Court, like Michael. Well, there was some joke he didn't want to do, and it's really funny.
Michael Moore,
maybe. But Lauren is very funny, because they're like, I can't do it, Lauren. He goes, well, just try it. And it's really great to have them be like, they are used to being having people agree with them right away. And Lauren's advice is always just to get it up on its feet.
I wrote a piece that was the opening of the last show. It had nothing to do with politics, but it was just a high school graduation where it was all the filthy names like, you know, come on, I want to lay and stuff.
Right.
And Lauren thought it would be fun to have John McCain in it as a faculty member. So I have a great tape of McCain laughing at the crudest stuff.
Yeah, he loved it.
He loved it, yeah.
But then we had to, his people said the senator can't.
Yeah, because, and the reason he couldn't, I think he has a great sense of humor, mm-hmm. and you right. can tell it by the, because he was hearing those names for the first time, and it was truly really funny. But I think that we live in a time now where that becomes an attack ad. You know, right. everything becomes an attack ad. At worst, you know, at the minimum on the internet.
Well, there is an attack ad against Al Franken out now that uses his like comedy rantings and you know, put together to make him look, you know, erratic and insane.
You should see the stuff we saw. Yeah.
It's so unfair to do that to Al. No, I mean it's. I think there's a certain behavior that you want, you know, obviously when someone's in office. But I think that, I guess my point of view is that you can be a very serious person and be funny.
Whose idea was it to get Jesse Jackson to do Green Eggs and Ham? That was a brilliant...
That's Franken. That's
yeah.
Franken.
Yeah, I think that was him.
I took a shower with John McCain.
That's true.
That's right. I wrote that piece.
You wrote it? He was a stalker, and he was right in my shower.
Yeah, I did a Lifetime movie.
It was a Lifetime movie.
With John McCain. I only so I could have, like, the title with the, you know, Ted, played by Senator John McCain, Republican Arizona.
I think that I want to go back to that for a moment.
The shower? Well, it was good.
No. No, I think that you have to believe that people have a sense of humor about themselves, because I don't think anybody can be serious for 4 years, you know. There's and so the idea that it's off camera, that part of them doesn't get shown, is it's not realistic.
So you did get, I mean. You got George W. Bush to be on just shortly before the election, kind of.
Both of them, both came on the presidential bash. Yeah,
you know, weirdly, they the one thing both campaigns said. You remember this that they obviously didn't want to take any chance of running into each other because there was no, you know, the likelihood of anything good coming out.
Bush
was
and Kerry,
okay. Bush and Gore.
Gore in 2000. They both came to do this.
We did a split screen thing that was assembled, you know, from different. And the way the thing worked out, they ended up being first. Almost, my God, it's going to be like the next day. And then it was the same day.
Yeah.
And then it was like they almost like ran into each other in the studio. And the great thing about my memory about that is like Gore was very much tougher to convince than Bush, because Bush was like, "Yeah, I'll do it." And Gore was like, he needed a lot of hand holding, and Franken interceded because Franken knew him very well, and so we were able to talk him into doing the stuff. But then we didn't have a Live from New York thing, and so I had the idea of, like, you know, Gore going, like, I, you know, normally you know, we end these things with Live from New York, but I just don't feel this would be dignified, so Governor. And then we got Jesse Ventura to do the Live from New York. So, and like, I remember on the phone, like, Ayala, one of our producers, like, calls the Minnesota governor's office, and it's like, and Jesse's in the background, and it's like, they want you to do Live from New York. Yeah, fine. And so I was like, I didn't get to see it. I'm listening in on a phone hookup. He was doing a hardball, and I just knew. I knew that if Jesse Ventura could do anything, he could do Live from New York. Right. But he did the perfect professional wrestler kind of thing. And I just heard the way he did it. I got to, you know, I don't need to look at the thing, you know.
So let's just talk about this year's election a bit to wrap up, because it's been such an amazing year. You did have to sit out a bit early on because of the writer's strike. That must have been...
Yeah, no, that was for the greater good.
I think it helped us, though. I know you it compressed the... We didn't have to, like, stay on top of, like, the less interesting, you know, more complicated things where there were, like, basically... you know, 7 or 8 candidates technically alive. And I think by the time we got to it, it was about Hillary and Obama.
Yeah.
You know, I think that helped
us. No. In that sense, it was good for us. It was just very frustrating not being on the air.
Yeah. So what was it like dealing with Obama? How to characterize him? There was discussion about like who would play him and how do you, you know, make fun of him. Nobody was really sort of making jokes about him. I remember, you know, that was a discussion. Like, could you?
Well, we were on the first show of last season in August. We got a call from Hillary Clinton's office that she wanted to come on that show. And although we really didn't have any sort of point of view on it because she called first, we said yes. And then the Obama people called a couple days later, and I said, no, we've already given that show away. But and the next available date was in November that he could do it. So we agreed that he would do that show, like November 3rd. And then the week of the first show, Hillary's people decided it wouldn't be right for her to do it. And they canceled. Now, you know, I'm great.
Would have won the nomination.
Yeah. I'm, no one transcends pettiness more quickly than I do. So it isn't something that I would have in any way. But there's something when people don't show up when they were the people who requested it. And not that they're not, they have important, evidently very important decisions to make. So, my sense is, I don't know how things would have turned out if she'd been on that first show, or if Obama had been on that first show. By the time he came, sort of momentum was starting to happen with
but
him.
It was still before Iowa. It was really interesting. Like the last time we had him, you know, he came in with like two other guys.
Yeah,
and I'm sure it'll be.
And
different.
Jim had written a piece for the first show, which was about her
inevitability,
her inevitability,
planning her in 2013 and on.
Yeah, and that sort of encapsulated what more than the media thing about Obama getting that encapsulated more the way the media was at that time. And I think if she'd been there. I think it would have been, people would have got a glimpse into who she is more than the kind of entitlement that seemed, you know, the way she was perceived at the time.
And to continue with surreal moments, I met Obama dressed as Dennis Kucinich.
You were dressed as Dennis Kucinich.
I was dressed as Dennis Kucinich.
It was awesome. That was actually really interesting because Amy was Dennis Kucinich. Kristen Wiig was Dennis Kucinich's wife sitting in your lap.
Right.
And Obama was laughing really hard and his guys were like, like, we gotta get out of here.
And I shook his hand with ears and a little suit.
I think when politicians overthink things and become super cautious and start eliminating things, they get farther and farther from who they are, and I think the audience senses it. Sort of my experience. You know, like, I don't know whether any of you picked up that that McCain might represent a Bush third term. Has that gotten through to anybody here?
I heard something.
Yeah, no, it's been mentioned.
We've seen some ads about that.
Yeah, no, and I'm saying, you go, well, we got it. We're right. There. Okay, now, what else? Do you have something else? Oh, you're going to go with repetition for 3 months? That's your idea? I know it's a big country. I know that to reach 300 million people is really hard. You have to repeat things over and over. But I think we're there. We get it. You've made your point. Mm-hmm. Now, give us another point or show something else.
And then it's easier for us to write new sketches. Yeah. Repetition hurts the sketch writer.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that gives some idea, I guess, about how you might approach dealing with Obama in further sketches. Looking at this race, which has so many twists and turns and interesting characters and unexpected things, just if you could talk for a bit about just how you're looking at the race and what sort of things you're picking up on.
I think we're all pretty anxious for that first debate. Yeah. I think that'll be a very interesting thing to see at this point because, as far as like when the ads sort of devolve into sort of attacky ads, that they're really hard to sort of parody because they're already a little silly to begin with. So, I mean, ideally, you know, we'll see them talking about issues and have a way to sort of make that comic rather than taking things that to some eyes are already comic enough. Mm-hmm. When they're talking about like the whole like, you know, lipstick on a pig thing seems like it's ripe for comedy, but when you actually try to sit down and have a take on it, it's sort of like, well, this is sort of too ridiculous to even talk about.
And Obama's speech at the convention, which was so heroic and strong and delivered perfectly. You know, you can't sort of do the parody of that, but I think you can in a debate when you start to see, because they're off guard. Wow. And the off guard moments is how, that's the glimpse we get of like, I'm not sure about that guy.
You picked
I was going to say, well, speaking for myself, I mean, to me, he's the scariest person to write for of in my entire run at the show. I mean,
Obama.
Yeah, because he's so fucking smooth, and it's he doesn't he's like a master jewel thief, like in a 1950s movie, who you know never leaves any fingerprints. No one ever saw anything. No one heard anything. And I mean, I'm not, and this isn't. No, I'm saying he's just really impressive as a figure. And I talk to people from other, you know, the South Park guys say the same thing. Other comics, so they go, wow, he doesn't have many handles, does he? I mean, you know, like for someone like me, like Al Gore was someone who was like a gift that would keep on giving, but he didn't. You know, for me, a lot of people thought like, oh God, well, you're lucky Bush won, you know, the Florida thing, and I really didn't feel that way at all. I thought Gore was a much richer thing, whereas Obama is just. He's tough. He's and I don't know any. I've seen people like who think they have the handle that I mean, at least I don't think it's that good. But I mean, so far there's been enough other things going on, like Hillary, Sarah Palin. It's inevitably we're going to have Obama and McCain.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to be sick that week.
Yeah.
and what about McCain? What do you see in him as something to mime?
Well, he obviously has lots of, like, the, you know, the my friends kind of, you know, I mean, he's got the, Daryl does a very good impression of him that is a work in progress. It's constantly in flux. But he's a little easier, I mean, for sure. I mean, that side of the ticket
we were going to do
the easy side.
We were going to do it. Jim had written an in one for Daryl as McCain, and then we got McCain, and Jim wrote one for McCain. You know, who's ever in charge? We're pretty much opposed. So, you know, the more you get, you can't get close, as it were, you know, and you can't go in with your own politics, you know, and if people are way over the line, you have to, that's what you do.
So in a way, back in November, when it seemed like Hillary was inevitable, you were poking fun at her, and then Obama seemed, you know, you were poking fun at Obama when he was.
Well, I wouldn't say, and I wrote it not really against Obama. It's more the media, and it was just it was kind of a combination of the, you know, people feel about Obama like that. This is different. This is more than just winning an election. This is about, you know, putting the race problem behind us, and the fact that he is a kind of inspiring. You know, to me, like in my lifetime, he's the best I've ever seen. I mean, I guess people go back to JFK as the only analogous thing, but they also. There was also an issue of there's something about Hillary. It was like she was a stand-in for her husband for punishment, and he wasn't around anymore. And there was a certain, it began, I think, with her vote against or vote for the Iraq war resolution, because that gave, like, the Daily Coast people, like, a reason to hate her, which sustained Obama for that whole first year. Because if she'd voted against the war resolution, I swear she'd have been the nominee, because there would have been no rationale for Obama's candidacy. But what I saw, especially the MSNBC, I watch almost nothing but MSNBC. but when you saw the way they really were relishing, just laying into her, it just made a nice kind of thing. And I you know, obviously those pieces were sort of Hillary heavy. You know, Fred was just sort of finding the impression, which is it's a tough thing to get down. Mm-hmm.
I guess just one last sort of thing about Obama, because it goes back to something you said about likability, this whole way that likability, and it seems like, as you were talking about, if you know, what's the flaw here, but that's one thing he seems to have trouble with, like appearing to be emotional or hit people on a gut level.
He doesn't have vulnerability because he isn't vulnerable.
Right, but that is something that is valued in politicians, this whole idea that you want to have a beer with them or they connect with people.
In the time that he was with us, for the few hours that he was with us, he was, incredibly impressive and charming. Yeah. There wasn't anything he didn't get or anything.
I grew up in Illinois, and so, I mean, he was going, there was like a receiving line, you know, people were, you know, and like, he's going, how do you do it? Like, hey, I'm from Joliet. And sort of the politician charm beam comes on. Yeah. He's quoting like street intersections in my town to, you know, let me know that he's a real hands-on senator.
Yeah, right.
But I sort of like that. I like the, but you know, like a lot of people, a lot of politicians, you would like want to have a beer with or think they're really cool guys. And with Obama, it's like you want to get his autograph. You know, it's a different thing.
And there, you know, obviously the celebrity ad and the all of that,
right,
put them on some kind of defensive thing, because you go, why are you paying any attention to this? But
it seems to work. That's why.
Evidently, it did. Yeah.
I'll take a shower with him. I'll let you know.
And what's your Biden too? Or?
Yeah, sure, all of them. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. If I had a dime for every guy she's taking a shower.
This is vodka.
Yeah. I think we're going to end on that note. So anyhow, we'll be watching every Saturday night till the election's over and beyond that. So
hopefully, yeah.
Thank you so much for being
with
us. Thank
you.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.